It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin is averaging nearly 5,000 new COVID-19 cases each day over the last week. We'll talk with a doctor about what needs to happen to bring the numbers down and what we should think about when planning holiday gatherings. First, while much of the focus from the fall election has been on the presidential, House, and Senate races, there were also some big ballot measures and referendums in other states. Four more states, South Dakota, Arizona, Montana, and New Jersey, voted to legalize marijuana. Mississippi passed a medical marijuana measure. Oregon will become the first state to decriminalize small amounts of other drugs. In Florida, voters approved a measure to increase the minimum wage to $15 an hour over time. And Colorado joins the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. Just a sampling there. There were other referenda involving gig economies, abortion, redistricting, and more. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Which ballot initiative results were you following? Were you most encouraged or discouraged by? Would you like to see some of these implemented in Wisconsin? Minimum wage increase, drug decriminalization, changing the way district boundaries are drawn. Do you think we should have this referendum process in Wisconsin, which we don't? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Louis Jacobson is a senior correspondent with PolitiFact and senior author of the Almanac of American Politics 2020. He wrote about these ballot initiatives for U.S. News and World Report. Lou, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yes, thank you.
Before we dig into some of these results, Lou, this is kind of alien territory for us here in Wisconsin. We don't have a binding statewide referendum process, asterisk, except for constitutional amendments that are put out there to the state by the legislature by passing it twice. So that's pretty rare. How common is this outside of Wisconsin?
You know, I don't have off the top of my head the number of states, but it is definitely a limited number of states, probably less than half. And a lot of them are in the West for whatever reason they sort of developed there. California is a huge state for them. Arizona, Washington, Oregon, for some reason, they sort of developed there and got deep into the political sort of environment there. So and this year there were more than 100 of them. And by the way, that figure does include both the citizen initiatives, which are placed on ballot by basically ordinary people or groups, as well as the ones you're talking about, which are the state legislature driven things that are sent to the voters. So there were definitely north of about 100 this year, of which I wrote about 70 before the election as being pretty significant ones. So it actually was a pretty big deal in a lot of places, at least where they had them this year. You did a good job summarizing some of the key ones at the top of the show. So do you want me to talk about some of those?
Well, yeah, but one headline from your piece on this was for many, you know, Democrats, apart from maybe winning the presidency, we still don't know that yet. But, you know, Democrats didn't do great in congressional and Senate races, or they kind of underperformed. But some progressive, more or less ballot measures did pretty well.
That is definitely true. Joe Biden's performance, particularly if he wins some of these uncalled states, is going to probably surpass expectations in the number of states that he won. He's going to probably, soon if he hasn't already, pass Hillary Clinton in terms of the margin of victory in terms of raw votes nationally. So the presidential picture was pretty good for the Democrats. Obviously, winning, of course, by itself is a good thing for the Democrats. Beyond that, ballot initiatives are some of the only positive signs for the in 2020 results. Congress, of course, they've got a longer shot to the Senate than they thought they had before the election, and they're probably going to end up losing a handful of seats in the House when the bulk of analysis had suggested they were going to gain at least some seats. It's sort of continuing a trend of the past couple election cycles where Democrats have done pretty well in ballot measures. It used to be when I started covering ballot measures in the mid 1990s, a lot of conservative ones were on the ballot, things such as anti same sex marriage ballot measures were big, term limits were big, and those are mostly supported by conservatives. And there are a lot of anti-tax measures now. Democrats or or their liberal allies have gotten pretty savvy about placing various ballot measures that are favorable towards their side, on the ballot in the states where they can. And it hasn't gone 100% well for them, but I think that on balance, in most of the important ones for this cycle, that Democrats have tended to do better, or liberals have tended to do better than the conservatives have.
Talking to Lou Jacobson from PolitiFact about ballot measures in states around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Lou, a lot of drug measures, as I mentioned, legalization or decriminalization in some states you might expect, and then in some not exactly liberal strongholds like South Dakota. Talk about the trends we're seeing there.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I think a lot of people used to frame this, and I did too, as sort of a liberal issue, or at the very least a libertarian issue. I would not have expected a couple of years ago that it would have enough support to pass in places like South Dakota, where it got 53%, in Montana, got 57%, unless the numbers are slightly, and then Arizona, 60%. New Jersey, you could see supporting it. It's a blue state, but certainly Montana, South Dakota are not the kind of places where you would expect a sort of progressive leaning measure to do so well, and they have. In Mississippi, it voted on the medical marijuana policy, and it passed that with 67%. Now, that's not as far-reaching as the recreational marijuana ones, but it's still in Mississippi. I mean, that is a pretty significant achievement for the folks who support decriminalization of drugs. And Oregon had two major votes. It voted to basically decriminalize a small possession levels of a variety of fairly serious drugs, including heroin, I believe. That passed with 59%, and the idea is that the savings of law enforcement would be used to fund addiction treatment. Even more strikingly, Oregon voters also, with 56% of the vote last I checked, voted to basically decriminalize psilocybin, if that's how you pronounce it, which is magic mushrooms. And also Washington, D.C., in a slightly different mechanical way, did something similar in terms of mushrooms. So that's sort of the next frontier. If those sorts of experiments play out well and are popular, you could see that spreading further as time goes by, as you could in some other red states, perhaps, which may currently have a medical marijuana provision, but not one in terms of recreational marijuana.
We're taking a look at some of the referendums that were on ballots in other states in the fall election. Lou Jacobson is our guest, senior correspondent at PolitiFact, senior author of the Almanac of American Politics 2020. We'll look at some non-drug related ones coming up. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of these ideas? Do you wish Wisconsin had a process like this where citizens, say, can bring up a ballot initiative and then vote on it? Would you want to see that here or no? And with that initiative or not, do you want to see Wisconsin follow these other states when it comes to decriminalization of drugs, increasing the minimum wage we'll talk about in just a bit, changes in election systems, abortion, and more? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about some of the many ballot initiatives that were voted on in other states around the country this election, on things like drug decriminalization, affirmative action, minimum wage, just to name a few. Lou Jacobson stays with us from PolitiFact. He's been writing about this. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you wish we had this process of a binding referendum here in the state? What do you think Wisconsin should follow suit one way or another on, say, decriminalizing drugs or changing our redistricting methods? 800-642-1234. Let's go to Florida now, Lou, and look at this minimum wage increase going up to $15 an hour over the course of time. What happened there?
Yeah, in Florida, you need 60% of the vote to actually pass a ballot measure. And in this case, they got 61 last I checked, which is quite striking, considering that Trump won the state. Clearly, there were a whole lot of voters who voted for Trump and who voted for this. In general, minimum wage measures have been pretty popular. A couple states have passed them. The idea, just as a general sort of policy principle, is generally pretty popular around the country. So it's, I guess, not too surprising that it passed, but coming in such a Republican year for the state of Florida is definitely notable.
Is that kind of a head scratcher for Florida Democrats? Like, hey, you like this policy that we Democrats like and Republicans don't? How do they account for that?
I think there is something to that. You know, the past, as I said, the past couple of cycles have shown, in general, a pretty good record for Democratic-leaning progressive ballot measures across the country. And it's not actually that rare to find, even in red states, supporting things like expansion of Medicaid, you know, under the Affordable Care Act, passing. So it's, you know, as if the voters in the state, or at least enough of the voters in the state, are kind of operationally liberal, but they may, you know, prefer a Republican because maybe the state GOP in their state is pretty strong and there aren't strong candidates. So it's certainly something that Democrats will try to build on. But there is such a strong partisan divide and polarization in this country at this point that it's really hard. As you see the Senate races, for instance, you know, there were some strong Democratic candidates, very, very red states, and they just couldn't win for the most part. I think a lot of that is part is just partisan polarization. Maybe the idea that it's a ballot measure, and so it's not strictly a partisan issue, it's more of a policy issue. Maybe that gives people a little bit more room to run away from their party identification.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Lori is with us in Iowa County. Lori, hi.
Hi. My question is, I live in Iowa County, and there was actually a referendum on my ballot in reference to the district boundary question. You haven't mentioned that yet, and also, I want to add, I have three daughters, all live in different counties in Wisconsin, one Milwaukee, one Dane, and one up in Wausau. I'm not sure if that's Marathon County. Sure what county that is. Yep. And it wasn't consistent across.
Right. So I can answer that one, Lori. Different counties can have advisory referenda on their ballots. So you might well see one in Iowa County, but not, say, Milwaukee or Marathon County. Those are not binding, but people do them to kind of promote a cause, in this case, like redistricting. Now, that said, Lou, there were some states that did tackle how they drew their boundary lines, their voting lines in their states. What did we see around the country?
Yeah, definitely. In fact, aside from the marijuana and the drug-based ballot measures, one of the biggest issues and potentially important ones were on basically how you run elections and sort of everything surrounding that. And two states took up a ballot measure about redistricting. Virginia appears to have passed theirs. It basically puts into place a bipartisan system, which was designed to diminish the ability of a single party to draw lines that favors themselves. This follows the passage of a number of ballot initiatives across the country. Michigan, for sure, a couple others in the recent past have done so. In the state of Missouri, voters passed, it was not, I don't think it was quite as strong and elaborate as the Virginia one was, but it did pass 2 years ago. And the state legislature, who had been basically, you know, solely in charge of redistricting, fought back, passed a law to put it to the voters to basically weaken what the voters had passed 2 years earlier, and that passed. So basically the voters spoke 2 years ago and then spoke again to kind of partially rescind what they'd already passed.
Let's bring on another caller. Nancy is with us in Waukesha County. Nancy, hi. Are you there, Nancy? Okay. I don't know. Nancy must have put her phone down. She wanted to ask about, I think, a general question about why the arguments for and against these binding referenda in states, putting things directly to citizens instead of relying on legislatures to do them. Lou, general thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a great question. Certainly it is a state's prerogative to like not actually have ballot measures available. And in fact, in North Dakota, which does have the process, the state legislature tried to put a ballot measure about ballot measures on the ballot to basically restrict how strong the process is, and the voters rejected it. You know, I think probably one of the most important things for in terms of ballot measures is that they do allow a sort of escape valve where if a state legislature is like very against, let's say, redistricting reform or campaign finance reform, they are never going to vote to change the policies or the rules of the game, basically, which got them into office. A ballot measure, if the citizens can get it on just by signatures and not have to worry about the state legislature, then they can do that. And so it is a way to have kind of reformist overhauls of the rules of the game in ways that can't be blocked by the current existing politicians.
We'll leave it there. Lou, thanks a lot for joining us today and sharing some of these.
Great. Thanks so much.
Louis Jacobson is a senior correspondent at PolitiFact. He's senior author of The Almanac of American Politics 2020. We talked to him today about how some of the ballot initiatives in states around the country fared during this election season. Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Watch are documenting the lives of Wisconsinites in this unprecedented time with a series of audio diaries called Outbreak Wisconsin. The service industry has been hit hard by COVID-19, forcing some bars and restaurants to shut down for winter, others to permanently close their doors. After being laid off back in March, Madison bartender Amy Moreland was able to go back to work this summer, but she's nervous that it won't last.
Things are very different, but very similar. I did go back to work. I am a bartender, but I'm also an events coordinator. When people are like, well, what do you do? And I'm like, oh, I get people to gather in groups of 50 or more. Well, that's canceled forever or for the foreseeable future. So most places, at least the places that I work, are outside only. Well, if the weather is bad, then that means that you don't work, or, you know, like they only do to-goes then. And we're doing our best. We really want to keep our community safe. We want to keep the employees safe. We want to keep our customers safe. We don't want to be the cause of anybody getting COVID. You know, and then there's the other hand where it's like we can't make any money that way. And it's like, you know, bartenders and servers don't get paid unless people come in. So you have two choices. Like, you can pack a bar and you can make money, or you can have a few people. And anyway, this is where we're at, is that we're, you know, we're making it right now, but winter is coming. Winter is coming, and a lot of doors are going to be shut. A lot of your favorite restaurants and bars will not survive this winter. As soon as it's too cold, we won't be able to be open. So, I mean, unless things change this winter where we're going to be able to have more people inside, again, like, we're going to get a lot of us are going to get laid off again. And it doesn't seem like things are getting better as far as numbers go. It seems to be, like, actively getting worse. I think that that's the thing, is that, you know, we're all getting ready to be laid off again for a long time. So, I mean, I know everybody that I know that's in the industry right now is just whatever they're making, they're saving. And we need help. I say right now. The service industry needs help. We need your help, or we're not going to we're not going to survive this winter. Many of us lost wages, even if we didn't lose our entire job. A lot of people that didn't lose their job completely will lose their job soon. I know it's a job that a lot of people like to look down on, but it was a job that was really great that you could get without a college education. You worked really hard at it, and you made good money. It was an American dream job. Like, you got paid for how hard you worked, and a lot of people are really struggling right now. And I really fear for the future for all of us. I think it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better. And I think we could really use some kindness. And I think we could really use our neighbors right now.
To hear more stories like this one, visit WPR.org/outbreakWisconsin. Coming up after the news, we'll talk with a doctor about the latest COVID-19 numbers here in Wisconsin and what to keep in mind as we consider whether and how to gather with families for the holidays. Also, as votes in the presidential election continue to be counted, we'll report on developments throughout the day. You can listen to our NPR news breaks. We're going to talk a little bit on Central Time, and then join us tonight at 8 for an NPR election update special with the latest news on the election from around the country here on Wisconsin Public Radio. You can also follow developments, including Wisconsin's election results, at WPR.org. And you can always join in with your thoughts on the news of the day and the big conversations going on in the country, or reach out to us with your own story ideas. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or you can respond to what we're talking about here, suggest future conversations, and just let us know how things are going in your neck of the woods. Also, be sure to keep track of us on Facebook, the Ideas Network Facebook page. And you can tweet us, if you're really concise, tweet us at Central Time WPR, and you can chime in with your thoughts on the stories we're covering there as well. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, get ready for a Wisconsin weekend with some great inspiration for comfort cooking. Get some recipes and share your own favorite comfort foods. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, Wisconsin reported 5,922 new cases of COVID-19 today and 38 more deaths from the virus. That comes after the state set single-day records for new cases on Tuesday and Wednesday and continues an upward overall trend for cases, deaths, and hospitalizations. Governor Tony Evers and public health officials have asked Wisconsinites to wear face masks, social distance, and reconsider indoor family gatherings as we approach the holidays. At the national level, we passed another milestone for the first time this week with 100,000 positive cases confirmed in one day. A public health doctor joins us now for a look at the latest trends and to answer your questions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about COVID-19? Are you curious about testing, symptoms, or how the virus spreads? Have you or your family been affected by COVID-19? And if you're working in healthcare and have a moment, we'd love to hear about your experience too. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Patrick Remington is a professor emeritus in the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Remington, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks for having me again.
Well, we've been talking about this, Dr. Remington, you and I, since really the beginning of this outbreak. Looking at the latest numbers in Wisconsin and nationwide, what is on your mind?
Well, just when you think you've seen the worst, then tomorrow comes and it gets even worse. It's really remarkable how this pandemic, not only worldwide and in this country, but I think in particular in Wisconsin, has taken off and exceeded our worst fears. When we were talking last spring with something on the order of 200, 300 cases per day. We thought that was a lot. And then in July, it was 500. September, it was over 2,000. And now it's 5,000, almost 6,000 cases in a day. And we're up to about 250,000 people in the state of Wisconsin who have tested positive. That's about 5% of the population. And when you figure that, you know, not everybody who's been infected has been tested, we might be 10, maybe 15% of the population has been infected with the virus. And as you mentioned, the number of deaths that come along with that, there are over 2,000 deaths. We anticipate by the end of the year, we'll probably have 5,000 people in the state of Wisconsin die from COVID-19. So those numbers are, you know, truly striking.
Early in the outbreak, I think around the country and definitely here in Wisconsin, there was a thought that this was something that was hitting big cities. I even heard from lawmakers saying this is a city problem. We're not so much worried about it in our rural part of the state. Could you talk about the geographic spread now?
Well, the virus doesn't care where you live. The virus needs to get from person to person. So anywhere people gather, whether it's in a big city or in a rural community, whether it's at a bar or at your home, as long as you're in close proximity to a person who's been infected and you don't take the precautions, either the person is not wearing a mask or you're not, or you're not engaging in hand washing or physical distancing, then the virus will be transmitted. So it was a matter of time before the virus that entered really through the large cities, and Seattle was a result of somebody flying to Seattle. Same thing with New York, with international travel. So that's obviously how the virus came into our country. But once here, it's just been spreading like wildfire. In particular, I encourage the listeners to look at the New York Times map, which shows where the hotspots are. And the hottest part of this pandemic is right now in the upper Midwest, in particular in Wisconsin. We are just, you know, at 6,000 cases per day. That's 6,000. That's 6% of all the cases in the United States, and we're less than 2% of the population. So we are at 3 to 4 times the rate that the rest of the country is experiencing.
I want to turn to some practical considerations now, and a question I think a lot of people might have over the last months or in the days to come, the question of, should I get tested? And I'll give you a concrete example of me. This week I got a sore throat, right? Any other year I wouldn't think twice about it. I'm in a pretty low-risk group, and so in my mind, I don't want to be the idiot who wastes medical resources getting tested for something I probably don't have, but I also don't want to be the idiot who doesn't get tested and spreads the disease, you know, to my household. How do I, and how does anybody in similar situations, weigh that question of, should I seek out testing?
Well, it's a great question. I think that advice has changed. Early in the pandemic, when testing resources were scarce, the recommendation was that, you know, simple sniffles or a sore throat wouldn't constitute a reason to come and get tested. You had to have fever, for example. Now that's not the case. You know, we want the percentage of tests that are positive to be low. It means that we're reaching out and finding not just the people who are really seriously ill and with symptoms, or even with mild symptoms. It means we're probably catching some people who are barely symptomatic, who might just have a runny nose or just maybe a sense of losing their sense of smell or taste. So that, we want that. And you shouldn't feel bad if you go in with some suspicion of being infected and you get a negative test. That's good news in a couple of ways. It means that we are testing enough people to make sure we stay ahead of the virus. And for you individually, it means that you're not infected. So I wouldn't have the feeling that you've wasted resources. In fact, that's how we want to be spending our resources, to make sure we're not just having 30 or 40 or 50% of our tests be positive. That means we're missing too many people who have mild symptoms and maybe no symptoms at all.
Well, to spoil the ending here, I did get the test. I'm eagerly awaiting a result. We are talking about COVID-19, the latest numbers, and getting some answers to your questions and mine at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Patrick Remington with us from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Let's bring on a caller now. We've got Dennis in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. I've heard something like if we're exposed to for 15 minutes to somebody with COVID-19, or if it's a cumulative a number of 15 minutes in like a week, and I think that has something to do with viral load. I was just hoping you could explain that.
Dr. Remington, yeah, that exposure question.
Yeah, it's a great question. This is not like a switch which is either on or off. This is a question of having enough exposure to let the virus really catch hold and then cause a serious enough infection to lead to an antibody response and some symptoms and hopefully not serious symptoms. And so the CDC has a guideline that is that says if you have 15 minutes of exposure to somebody who's been tested positive, and that can be at one sitting or it can be accumulated over, you know, some period of time, 5 minutes here and another 5 minutes there. So that constitutes exposure. And what we found is that the virus really needs to be present in a high enough concentration to lead to a significant risk of becoming infected. So, again, you know, to have the abundance of caution, if you're exposed to anybody who's been tested positive, I would recommend that you either call your healthcare provider or your health department and ask what they think about the exposure. Because, you know, we're not very good judges of whether, you know, we were actually 6 feet away all the time. The type of air circulation, was it indoors or outdoors? And also how long that might have been. Whether the person you were exposed to, even if they tested positive, were they symptomatic? Were they coughing or sneezing? Were they wearing a mask? So there are a lot of variables, but I use this expression that dilution is the solution, and that if that exposure was outdoors and you were far away, and better yet, if people were wearing masks, then even if that person tested positive, you haven't had a significant exposure. But again, the other end of the spectrum is if you're indoors closer than 6 feet, people aren't wearing masks, and that's 15, 20 minutes or more, that constitutes a significant exposure and definitely should lead to quarantine and possibly testing.
Dennis, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Tom with us now in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. I'm wondering, is there any information as to what the degree of reduction in the risk of contracting the virus if one is wearing a mask?
Great question.
Well, yeah, that's a great question. And this is an area that's been of some discussion in the media and I think some frustration for scientists, in that early on during the as the pandemic evolved, the sense was, the evidence appeared to be, that masks were not very effective in preventing the spread of COVID-19. And then as people observed actual practice, what actually happened in communities and in barbershops and nail salons, is that the risk of transmission was observed to be less when individuals who were ill were wearing a mask. And so the early recommendation was that wear a mask to protect others, because you might be sick and not know it. And there's good evidence now that the virus is less likely to get into the air and to spread within 6 feet or even as an airborne contagion. And then as time went on, some observations were made that people who wore masks were less likely to get infected themselves. And so now the recommendation is you're wearing a mask primarily to protect others in case you're sick and don't know it, but also it seems to protect yourself from illness from others. You're less likely to touch your face or the mucous membranes in your face with your hands. And now, what's the exact risk reduction? That's really hard to know. Is it 50% less? Is it? It depends on so many factors. It depends on your symptoms. It depends on the kind of masks. You've seen some people wear masks, you know, on their chin, and it hardly covers the mouth and not their nose. Well, that mask isn't going to be very effective. Other masks are, you know, tight-fitting and made of, you know, the materials that an N95 would be made of, and those are going to be much more effective. But again, some masks worn properly is better than no mask, and it both protects others and protects yourself.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Dr. Patrick Remington, Professor Emeritus in the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at the latest on COVID-19 here in the state and answering your questions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about COVID-19, about things like testing or transmission, how to flatten the curve in Wisconsin, or do you have a personal experience to share dealing with the disease, maybe in your family or as a healthcare worker yourself? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our talk about COVID-19 in Wisconsin with Dr. Patrick Remington, Professor Emeritus in the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Heather is with us next in Madison. Heather, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to emphasize and reinforce what I've heard you say now a couple of times, which is I've experienced healthcare providers who are not following the current guidelines, haven't made the mental switch that testing is no longer limited. And just because you don't have symptoms doesn't mean you shouldn't get a test. I have acquaintances who've received that from their healthcare professional. And then, even though I am a scientist but not a healthcare professional, when I tell them, hey, your healthcare professional's not for, you know, following the guidelines, then I get the, well, blah, blah, blah kind of thing. So I'm a little concerned that there's some folks who aren't following it, either they didn't want to hear it that way, i.e. the patient, or, you know, folks haven't made the switch. I think on both sides, I'm seeing some inconsistency, so I'd really like to emphasize, get tested.
Interesting. Heather, thanks a lot. Dr. Remington, is the message out there in the healthcare community that, yes, maybe we should be erring on the side of testing more people?
Well, I think Heather makes a great point. We are getting mixed messages, sometimes even from the CDC. I recommend that people, you know, this is a good time to be a smart consumer and to look to the CDC or Department of Health Services for guidance. And I think anytime the epidemiology and the science is evolving so rapidly along with the guidelines, that it's sort of a shared responsibility. I mean, we hope our healthcare providers and health systems keep up with the information, but sometimes it changes from day to day and from community to community. So, I think it's part of the partnership with your doctor to come in and share information you've heard and certainly ask, because things have changed. I can remember specifically guidance where, If you didn't have symptoms, including a fever, that you weren't to get tested, and that's not the case now. And there are instances where, even without symptoms, people may want to be tested. That has to do with your own risk of being infected, but also the risk that you might infect others. And so people are, we're all learning more about this virus, and sometimes you bring some of that knowledge, you know, to the healthcare system and to your doctors.
Thanks for that call. Jean joins us now in Stevens Point. Jean, hello.
Hi, I have a question. One day last week, I suddenly lost my sense of taste, and later in the day developed some body aches and a headache with no fever. And I went in and got tested and tested negative. And according to my work protocol, I'm a healthcare provider, I could go back to work, but I chose to self-isolate quarantine for 10 days because I couldn't think of anything else that would cause a loss of taste without any other sinus issues. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are as to whether or not I was a false negative.
Well, that's a great question. And this is, you know, a time when everybody's using terminology that, you know, might not have been used before, the idea of false negatives. They do happen. No test is perfect. And so it's possible that for some reason, either because of the mechanical swabbing or just where the virus happened to be, that you were infected and the test, it turns out, didn't read as being positive. And so I think, again, your point being that the abundance of caution would be to avoid going back to work where you may be potentially infect others. No test is perfect. And if I were to be infected today, the test wouldn't, the virus wouldn't be discoverable until Sunday or Monday, and I might not have my first symptom until Tuesday or Wednesday. And so a lot of times people test too early, they get exposed, and they go in the next day and they get a negative test. Or, as we've heard in many situations, you test everybody, they all test negative, and then they go and play football or go to a party, and sure enough, somebody either was a false negative test or they tested before the virus actually began to be discoverable. So tests are not perfect, but I think generally, they're effective as a whole, but again, sometimes the information is not as accurate as we'd like it to be.
Thanks for that call, Gene, and good luck to you. Mary joins us next in Appleton. Mary, hello.
Hi, I lost you before. I just wondered your answer to indoors in cleaning house after the people have left. And I'm keeping to myself a lot. I'm not living a dangerous, risky lifestyle and going to bars or doing anything like that. Wash my hands a lot. And I do wear a mask, and I have a hard time doing that when I'm cleaning a larger bathroom. It's very difficult. So there's no way I'm going to wear it for 3-4 hours and I clean the house. Not going to happen. Going to have to not work. So is it safe after somebody leaves? If so, how long should I wait?
So Mary, house cleaner, how could she be safe given that in some cases she says you can't keep that mask on while washing the bathroom?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, obviously, thanks for the work you do. It's really important that, you know, this is a team effort. And our healthcare system includes not just people providing care to individuals, but everybody helping keep rooms clean and sterile. There's very little evidence that a virus would be on a surface and then become airborne again. And that's what you'd be concerned about. Once an individual leaves a room, even if they were infected, there is a slight chance that it's airborne, maybe for a short period of time. But again, that does not seem to be the main way COVID-19 is transmitted. So I would think that the key in cleaning rooms or anything, in cleaning house where you may have contaminated products or surfaces, would be to engage in good hand hygiene. Make sure your hands are washed. Sometimes the use of gloves helps. But that the use of a mask, you know, again, the chance of a virus being on the surface and getting aerosolized in sufficient dose to cause an infection would be very low. So I think, you know, unless you're, you know, in an area with very poor ventilation with people who've been really sick, that the mask wouldn't be as important as good hand hygiene.
Thanks, and good luck to you, Dr. Remington. Just in 30 seconds or so, advice for the holidays coming up.
Well, advice for the holidays. I think we are at a point when people do want to gather, and I just think people ought to look at pushing the pause button and think about the risk, not just for yourself. For example, if you're a young person, you may have a relatively low risk. Still, 10 to 20 people have died in this state in their 20s and 30s. So it can happen. But think about the risk for others. And you may unknowingly bring infection to an older relative, and that would be devastating. So I think if you do gather, do so in very low-risk situations, use of masks, physical distancing, outdoors preferably. Today, fortunately, this week, we've had a reprieve. We've been able to spend a little more time outdoors. But if you do have to get together, consider quarantining for the 2 weeks prior. And basically, that assures your family members that you're not infected at the end of the period of quarantine.
Thanks to Dr. Patrick Remington for joining us again today, answering your questions about COVID-19. He's a professor emeritus in the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Find more Wisconsin COVID info at wiscontext.org. With all the tension surrounding the election, here's one race that was decided in a landslide, and I think just about everyone will be able to support the winner. Wilbur Beast was elected as the mayor of the town of Rabbit Hash, Kentucky. In a multi-candidate race, he won a decisive 13,000 votes out of about 23,000 cast. Oh, forgot to mention, Wilbur Beast is a French bulldog. As reported on the Hill website, Rabbit Hash Kentucky has a 20-some year tradition of electing dogs as their mayors. Technically, money talks in these races. Each dollar donated amounts to one vote, and then the proceeds go to the local historical society, which organizes the festivities. Wilbur Beast replaces the previous mayor, a rescue pit bull named Brynneth Paltrow, elected in 2017. The second and third place finishers, a beagle and a golden retriever, won't be left out. They get to serve as ambassadors for the town. I want to know, does anyone here in Wisconsin or our nearby neighbors have anything like this where you elect a local animal of some sort to an honorary position? Or, I don't know, a real position of authority? Do what you do. I'd love to hear about it. Send us an email at ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Are there any town ferrets out there? I'd be happy to serve. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.